I was a mole in the ground, I'd tear those mountains down.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. It's just after 9 a.m., which means time for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm your host, Joe Clement. The Old Mole is a political radio zine that strives to bring you radical intersectional analyses, constructive materialist criticism, and visions of solidarity and collective power. We promote actors in and ideas for grassroots democratic movements that aim to change the world by organizing for the power to do it. Today's show starts out with Bill Resnick and Caitlin Day, a local community organizer with Stop the Sweeps and the End Clean and Safe campaign. They'll be talking about that and alternatives to the city's policies of sweeping, harassing, and criminalizing the homeless. On the left in the law, Jan Hawken and Mike Snedeker take up recent lawsuits against oil companies for damages related to knowingly contributing to the impacts of the climate crisis, and how to think about this legal strategy in the context of climate justice and activism. And to round out today's show, I'm going to have Samantha Bryce on again to talk about the picket on Thursday outside of the Old Town Voodoo Donuts. I was there. There were well over 100 people. It was very lively. I and several others churned away people from Voodoo Donuts, and we will talk more about that as well as the organizing and what it's like to work at Voodoo Donuts and why workers sought the union and what has happened in the process. You can listen to past episodes and segments of The Old Mole at our KBOO webpage, kboo.fm/oldmole. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter by searching for The Old Mole Variety Hour. Our email is oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com. We love to receive feedback, questions, or your ideas for contributing to or being on The Old Mole. Now, we turn it over to Bill Resnick and Caitlin Day. Bill?
Hi, Caitlin Day. Welcome to KBOO and the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Hi, Bill. It's nice to be here. Thank you.
Caitlin Day is a community organizer, started out here in Portland organizing and leading the Portland State University Student Union, wrote as her thesis at Portland State, fighting back against criminalization of the homelessness. She is now organizing with Stop the Sweep here in Portland and the Western Regional Advocacy Project. She's leading the struggle in Portland with several others against the criminalization of the homeless here, particularly in the business district. So, Caitlin Day, what are those enhanced service districts, also called business improvement districts? The downtown enhanced service district is known as Clean and Safe. You've named it Dirty and Dangerous. Tell us why the city set them up and why they're so objectionable.
Yeah, absolutely. So enhanced services districts are Portland's local version of business improvement districts, as you said. Business improvement districts exist in almost every major city in the United States. Essentially, what they are is they're geographically bounded districts where all of the property owners within that district are required to pay a fee, which is then funneled to a business organization who can use that to provide additional services within that area. However, those services are often hiring private security who patrol in public space, as well as contracts with the Portland Police Bureau for extra officers. Sometimes they contract with the district attorney's office for prosecution services. And ultimately, all of these services are targeting unhoused people within those districts, trying to push them out of public space. So Clean and Safe is the downtown ESD. We have three of them in Portland. There's also the Lloyd District in the Central East Side. Clean and Safe is the longest running ESD and is also the largest. They have a budget of about $5 million annually. Over $3 million of that money goes to private security. So they are also managed by Portland Business Alliance, and a lot of the money from Clean and Safe is used to fund Portland Business Alliance's lobbying efforts, which often is lobbying against unhoused people and for more criminalization policies and just generally for large property owners and business interests.
Yeah, the Business Alliance and their board of directors, they're all property owners. And in fact, in voting on policy, my understanding is they get the votes are even proportioned according to the net worth of the commercial buildings that this interest owns. It's really bizarre. It's the wealthiest of the wealthy in Portland real estate who make public decisions, decisions which should be made in public in their own private rooms, and they don't even keep data, the whole operation, on what it's doing. Tell us about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So ESGs are very fundamentally undemocratic because it puts a lot of power into the property owners, like you were saying. And in particular, it's putting power into the largest property owners in downtown. So no property owners actually get to vote on the district. It is solely in the hands of city council. However, to terminate the district, it has to be an amount of people who petition to dissolve the district that make up 33% of the property value, which puts a lot of small property owners at a disadvantage, and they have way less of a say in keeping the district than larger property owners. So that's definitely a huge issue, as well as, like you were saying, a lot of things are happening behind closed doors, and there's very little oversight of these districts. There was an audit that was released in August 2020, which documented that Enhanced Services districts, since their inception really, have seen almost no oversight from the City of Portland. Really, the only thing the City of Portland has done, it has collected the fees and then distributed them to the business nonprofits, such as Portland Business Alliance. But they do not track the outcome. They do not track any complaints from private security officers. They're supposed to do that now since the audit came out, but there hasn't really been that much evidence for that. And we should find out more this coming August because the auditor's office will have to do a one-year review of the progress the city has made to meet the recommendations of the audit.
We do know something about what they're doing. It seems to me one important fact, which is hard to digest, that over 50% of police arrests in this town are of homeless people, and many, many of them are for sure because they have all these police assigned there, and they also have their own private little court in some ways, a community, whatever it's called, a community court, but we should get into that. We do know one thing, that 50% of the, over 50% of the arrests in Portland are of the homeless. Those police are doing, much of it is coming from the downtown. And we also know that the Safe and Clean, Dirty and Dangerous, actually, that the people there assist in the police sweeps. And since they have sort of an open phone call to the police, there's no doubt that they initiate some of these sweeps. Am I wrong about that? Is that part of the way they operate?
Yeah, definitely. Really, there's no data on it because they don't collect that data, but definitely anecdotally, there are many people we've spoken to who have been asked to leave, and that has been by clean and safe security officers, and they've been harassed, and sometimes it can lead to arrests. The way their security program is set up is they contract with a private security company called Portland Patrol, Inc. That private security company allows for both armed and unarmed patrols in public space. And we really like to emphasize that these private security patrols are in public space, on public sidewalks. That's very unique for private security. Oftentimes, they only patrol on private property. But with this contract, they are allowed to patrol on public sidewalks. And so not only do they have the private security, but they're also contracting with the Portland Police Bureau. They're directly funding four officers, but Portland Police Bureau also provides an additional two officers. So there's six officers within the Portland Police Bureau who are patrolling solely within the Clean and Safe District. And so not only are they doing that, but then they're being jointly supervised by the Central Precinct with the Portland Police Bureau, but also by Portland Patrol, Inc., and they share radio and dispatch and are always working in close coordination. And then there's also the Downtown Security Network, which is a monthly meeting. It's not open to the public, and it's a meeting between all the private security companies downtown, Portland Business Alliance, the District Attorney's Office, as well as Portland Police Bureau. So they're all coordinating with each other, business, police, private security, and working hand-in-hand. And it does contribute to the arrests of unhoused people. We've seen the arrest data, and although we can't establish causation yet, it is notable how many arrests are concentrated within the Clean and Safe District. And we really believe that has to do with the fact that there is a way larger security and police presence in downtown.
This is Cable Radio, your old mole hour. I'm talking to Caitlin Day with the group Stop the Sweep. and with the coalition End Clean and Safe that she calls Dirty and Dangerous. That coalition is attempting to end the criminalization of Portland's homeless. We've so far discussed how objectionable it is to have a few very rich downtown property owners running a private police force with no oversight or accountability, and they don't seem to, at least maybe until recently, keep data on their street encounters, their arrests. With that said, the question becomes, if Clean and Safe is eliminated, what should be done about homelessness, not just downtown, but across the city? Now, before that, Caitlin, they... Clean and Safe is funded by a contract with the city, and it can be ended by not renewing the contract. That contract comes up for renewal this fall. So right now, in current struggles, the End Clean and Safe Coalition is building forces for that, for persuading the city council to end that contract and begin this new chapter for dealing with homelessness. Tell us how that works.
Yeah, Clean and Safe has a 10-year contract, which is really ridiculous, actually. It's a very long contract, and it's up for renewal this year. It'll be another 10-year contract unless they decide to change that. So it's going to be up for vote on September 23rd, so we're gearing up for that right now. There's been a series of listening sessions that have happened. Most of the testimony at these listening sessions have been in opposition to the contract renewal. And the only reason these listening sessions have happened in the first place was because our coalition put out a set of demands, essentially asking the city of Portland to create a robust public process, because that's never happened in the past for these contract renewals. It typically happens behind closed doors. They vote for it in a city council meeting, and it's business as usual. And we didn't want that to happen. And so we're advocating for them to vote no on the contract. But if they are going to go forward with the contract, we want to see some major changes. And we put out a list of demands. The main ones to focus on is we are asking them to get rid of their private security contract, as well as getting rid of their contracts with the Portland Police Bureau and District Attorney's Office. And finally, we really want to see Portland Business Alliance taken out of the equation, both with Clean and Safe and really ESCs in general, because they use it to advance their lobbying, and it's just a very inappropriate use of public funds.
Ending the contract is the first step, but if the contract can be withheld, the city would be forced, including the downtown businessmen and the real estate moguls, to begin considering a humane, compassionate policy that might even reduce the problems of both the city and the homeless. It certainly is when it's been tried. So, Caitlin, let's get back to that. With Clean and Safe gone, homelessness will still be with us. We surely don't want more policing. We need a just transition. So what would that just transition look like? What should the city do to end homelessness?
It's definitely a very complicated topic, but at the baseline, to end homelessness, we need more housing. And that's definitely a larger discussion. But I think a lot of the immediate needs are really just allowing people to exist in public space. That's kind of the fundamental problem with these contracts, is people are not legally allowed to be in public space, which we find very inappropriate. So allowing space for people to be in public space, but also there are definitely major concerns of, like, we need more hygiene facilities. I think the pandemic really put that out on display, how important hygiene is. And it's good to see the city actually moving on it for once, but it's definitely not enough. So we would love to see more hygiene access, both in downtown, but all throughout Portland. And in regards to places for people to stay right now, we are a little worried with the city's proposals to create safe encampments, mainly because these are city-run, and we would like to see more peer-led and autonomous villages that are led by the people who live in the villages, instead of these encampments that are run by the city and nonprofits, and oftentimes people are being pushed into them. They don't have a lot of power. So really what it comes down to is really respecting the autonomy of people who are on the streets and giving them space to self-determine what they need, because it's going to differ from person to person. And right now it seems like the city, the county, and the state really see these kind of solutions as a one-size-fits-all. And also a lot of people don't want to look to unhoused people for answers and think that they have the answers and they can just tell people what to do and how to help them. but that's just not the case. And so we like to really encourage that we talk to unhoused people and that they're able to self-determine what they need to really survive.
Yeah, I was reminded that Clean and Safe does do some decent things. One of the things they do is for some of the jobs that they hire for, which is not a substantial use of their monies, most of it goes to security personnel, some of them armed. But some of the work done by Clean and Safe workers is cleaning up the downtown. And they hire people from the homeless community and from people coming out of addiction. It seems to me we have to, it's important to think about a just transition from this. And those people take pride in actually what they're doing, even if they have reservations about being also commandeered into the sweeps and into throwing away the desperately small life savings of the people on the streets. It seems to me important to make a just transition. In fact, consistent with what you were saying, we would want to hire people from the homeless community to be, I think in the Eastside industrial districts, they were called ambassadors, but people to reach out to those who are having trouble in the streets. I mean, their personal troubles, which God knows all of us have, theirs are in public. It seems to me that that kind of offers of transitional help and diffusing tensions, that can be done by homeless people with some amount of apprenticeship. Is that part of the program?
Yeah, I can talk about that a little bit. Obviously, the name is Clean and Safe, and they usually divide it into two portions. There's the cleaning portion and the safety portion, which the safety is the security and police that we've already talked about. And the cleaning portion is through Central City Concern. They do hire unhoused and formerly unhoused people to do the cleaning for Clean and Safe. Right now, we're not really targeting that program. We're more focused on the security. However, there are concerns with that program. Mainly, it goes back to what I was just talking about earlier, kind of that top-down approach, where Central City Concern's really in charge, and they are employing people, but oftentimes, it's not a living wage, it's not a union job, it's not meaningful employment, and it can sometimes be very exploitative. And that's not to say those kind of programs can't work. I think a really great example of one of them would be Ground Score, the peer-led initiative, which is led by unhoused people, and they hire people to pick up trash. And it's a lot more horizontal. It comes from the unhoused community and not necessarily through a service provider. And so I think we want to see more of those kind of approaches to it where it's coming from the unhoused community because some of these top-down approaches are just not what people actually need. So I definitely think there could be changes to the cleaning program that's part of Clean and Safe, and there definitely is already work being done to do that.
This is Cable Radio, your old mole hour. I'm talking to Caitlin Day with the Coalition End Clean and Safe that she has written about and calls dirty and dangerous. That coalition is attempting to end the criminalization of Portland's homeless. We've so far discussed how objectionable it is to have a few very rich downtown property owners running a private police force. Also discussed how their contract is coming up, and also discussed what can replace a criminalization of homelessness policy. That there really is a positive alternative. Hey, Lente, what can and should KBOO listeners be doing?
So in regards to the Clean and Safe contract specifically, most of the listening sessions are over now. However, the contract will go up to vote in September, and there will be more public testimony taken. We're also trying to encourage the city to do even more listening sessions, which we will update people about that. But really the main place to find information right now is we just launched a website. It's called endcleanandsafe.org. So that's a great place to get updates about what's upcoming. But yeah, definitely just keeping an eye out on it. And if there's any time to give public testimony, that's a great way to get involved. And as far as just in general, fighting against criminalization in Portland, there is an opportunity this Thursday, the encampment at Laurelhurst Park. All five city commissioner offices released a letter and said that they're going to sweep. And there is a call for folks to come support that on Thursday, starting at 7 a.m. To support the residents. That can look a lot of different ways. Some people just need help with moving and also may need help as like a buffer from police because there is going to be police presence there. So definitely showing up at Laurelhurst Park throughout the week will be very helpful.
Yeah, Caitlin Day, thanks so much for talking to us. Thanks for your good work.
Thank you.
You noble diggers all, stand up now, stand up now. You noble diggers all, stand up now. The wasteland to maintain, seen cavaliers by name. Your digging does maintain, and persons all defame. Stand up now. With spades and hoes and ploughs, stand up now, with spades and hoes and ploughs, stand up now. Your freedom to uphold, seen cavaliers are bold, to kill you if they could, and rights from you to hold, stand up now, diggers all. The lawyers they conjoin, stand up now, the lawyers they conjoin, stand up now. To arrest you they advise, such fury they devise, the devil in them lies, and have blinded both their eyes, stand up now.
That was Chumbawamba singing from their English Rebel Songs album, The Digger's Song by Gerald Winstanley. Protest song that goes back to 1650 or so when the diggers were trying to reclaim the common land and were kicked off. This was during the centuries of capitalist dispossession of peasants who had themselves dispossessed many of the feudal elites. It is a situation that carries forth with us today with these sweeps and with the criminalization of people's needs. And before that, Bill Resnick was talking with community organizer Caitlin Day with Stop the Sweeps PDX about the End Clean and Safe campaign. Another song about the diggers written in the 1960s or 70s by Leon Rosselson called World Turned Upside Down has a line about how from the men of property, the orders came. They sent the hired men and troopers to wipe out the diggers' claim, tear down their cottages, destroy their corn. They were dispersed, but still the vision lingers on. And we really are talking about the men of property when we talk about the Portland Business Alliance. The class war never ended. I'm Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour. In their Left in the Law segment today, Jan Hawken and Mike Snedeker take up the wave of recent lawsuits filed by cities and states against the oil industry in the U.S., based on the industry's damage to communities and covering up their own scientific data on the lethal threat of fossil fuels to the planet. Jan and Mike talk about the importance of these lawsuits in the broader climate justice movement, as well as some of the legal and political challenges. They begin their segment by commenting on an online news report by Greenpeace UK, where a senior ExxonMobil lobbyist talks about how he works to fight off U.S. climate legislation. Listen to what the lobbyist has to say.
Did we aggressively fight against some of the science? Yes. Did we join some of these shadow groups to work against some of the early efforts? Yes, that's true. But there's nothing illegal about that. We were looking out for our investments. We were looking out for our shareholders.
Mike, those were the words of a senior lobbyist with ExxonMobil, explaining that covering up research on climate change is perfectly legal. I don't know how this interview affected his future job prospects, but let's start with his claim that nothing the oil lobby does is illegal. Is he correct on that score?
Well, unfortunately, he's close. You know, the oil lobby gave $140 million to politicians in the 2020 election cycle alone. They are a chief architect of the laws themselves. The senators, the representatives, politicians down to local levels are dependent on oil companies for their contributions. They're even dependent on them for people who draft the actual laws that govern how they shape opinion. So, yeah, much of what they do, even most of what they do, is entirely legal.
I mean, during the Trump administration, of course, we were very aware of the horrifying rollback in regulations and issuing permits right and left for drilling on public lands. Now the Biden administration has pulled back on some of that, but has been very disappointing on many fronts. So the fossil fuel industry is still a big player through their, you're saying through their lobbyists.
Well, what people have done in response that has been pretty effective and is really gaining momentum now that has become clear that the fossil fuel industry itself has long known that climate change is real and that its own activities have been responsible for a big chunk of it, are civil suits.
Before going into some of the civil suits, can you explain some of the difference between a criminal prosecution, which some are calling for, including a recent article in Jacobin magazine, versus filing civil suits?
Well, criminal prosecutions are all very hypothetical now because there are no criminal laws that the corporations are violating. But civil suits are really here and now a reality. The most effective ones evolved from what were formerly nuisance lawsuits 500 years ago in England. If you bought 25 hogs and put them in your backyard and they started rooting through your neighbor's fences, they could sue you as creating a nuisance. And that became part of the common law that now is effective in every single state and county and has been used in very sophisticated ways. Most recently in Oklahoma, the state received $500 million from Johnson & Johnson as settlement for damages done by the opioid crisis.
Some nuisance.
Yeah.
How do the impacts of fossil fuel get pursued through these nuisance laws?
Well, like the big case in the U.S. Supreme Court was initiated by the city of Baltimore, which has been profoundly affected by the rising ocean. They pointed to concrete ecological damage and named the fossil fuel companies as responsible. So what the Exxon and other equivalents have done typically is try to move it all to federal court, which doesn't have that common law tradition, and say that the Clean Air Act and various congressional legislation has preempted all these local lawsuits. It's got, you know, it's a colorable legal argument. I don't think it'll work in the long run, but it achieves delay. And since they're an industry in retreat now, delay is maybe the best result they can hope for.
So in the Supreme Court ruled what seemed to be in favor of the fossil fuel industry in that Baltimore case in May, by 7-1 ruling, which was surprising. I think only Sotomayor voted against the fossil fuel industry, but it seemed to be a narrow ruling on procedural grounds. It shifted it back to the state. So in that sense, was it a partial victory for these state and city cases because it did go back to the, I think, Maryland courts?
Well, it's essentially a punt. It's not going to be really determinative of anything. And what the cities and counties and states want to do is to discover. That's the power of a civil suit, to force them to make admissions under oath, to pose interrogatories to Exxon, asking them precise questions. What did you know? When did you know it? And then if they tell lies, they can be prosecuted criminally under long established criminal laws. To hold legislative hearings, if you have a state that's not so dependent on fossil fuels, maybe they can have a committee hearing examining the effects of climate change, and then people have to testify under oath. Again, there's a way to get them under the criminal system by either having them admit what they've done, admit what they've known, or to deny it and then prosecute them.
Well, let's talk about the complaint filed last year in a district court in Minnesota by its Attorney General, Keith Ellison, against the American Petroleum Institute, ExxonMobil, Koch Industries, and Flint Hills. Ellison gained national recognition for his role in prosecuting Derek Chauvin for the murder of George Floyd. The opening sentence in the complaint is quite damning and direct. And this is from the complaint itself. Minnesota is in the midst of a climate change crisis, and goes on to say, warming will continue with devastating economic and public health consequences across the state, in particular, disproportionately impact people living in poverty and people of color. Goes on to say the economic devastation and public health impacts from climate change were caused in large part by a campaign of deception that defendants orchestrated and executed with disturbing success. So can you speak to this strategy, how in the complaint and the likelihood of it moving anywhere in the courts?
What they want to do is highlight recent admissions. There's been a profound change, I think, in the general attitude, and one that is pregnant with possibilities of a really serious shift in sentiment, which began in 2015 when Columbia University and the LA Times discovered all the research that Exxon had done, original and pretty deeply and well-constructed research showing that climate change is really real and their own activities are a chief cause of it. So now they're not in the position, what they've done via their nonprofit institutes and whatnot is to create a picture of climate change as something that's really complicated, that there's evidence here, but there's evidence there that we're all responsible for.
Right. That diffusion of social responsibility that to some extent is reproduced or perpetuated by even some in the climate movement itself, that we're all guilty and,
sure.
And sinned and need to be saved by grace, but which is to some extent the case. But how does this shift that moral responsibility?
What they're going to do by saying defendants orchestrated a campaign of deception is that even while their own research showed that their work caused climate change and caused deleterious effects, they said at the same time that we don't know what is really causing all this. We may or we may not be contributing a little bit. So they want to hammer on these admissions to use the research Exxon has done to make them admit that they've done it, that they knew about it, that they've even allocated capital on the basis of that research, to make it more and more obvious that they're running a campaign of deception.
Which is a more important grounds for the complaint than just somebody's executive saying, well, I didn't get the memo, you know,
because right.
They very, very intentionally distorted and deceived even their own research findings.
Yeah, they want to be able to say, well, you did get the memo. And not only did you get the memo, you decided to spend $80 million here rather than there because of the memo. I mean, you know all about it. You always have. Not well, always, but certainly in the recent decades.
And some of this, the translation of research findings into a public-facing campaign comes through the American Petroleum Institute. And I thought it was interesting that they were a plaintiff. Often there's not enough discussion of what is the American Petroleum Institute. Do you think they have a different status in this complaint? Are they somewhat like the National Rifle Institute, Association of the NRA, in their role of kind of covering the tracks of industries targeted by social justice movements?
Their whole purpose is to create an air of detached neutrality of science, of research, and they're all entirely funded by fossil fuel companies. And it's all about shifting opinion. And they were named as a guilty party here because they are just another face of the same institutions, of the corporations that dominate fossil fuel policy. They've been around since almost the beginning of the whole industry. A really interesting and I think a devastating quote was made by Edward Teller, the man responsible for the hydrogen bomb, in 1959, on the 100th year of the fossil fuel industry's history in the U.S. He said in New York to the API, as it's called, he said, you know, really, because of greenhouse emissions, the Arctic's going to melt and New York City's going to be underwater. So we got to be careful. He said that in 1959. This is the idea that this is all kind of mysterious and murky and diffuse, and that each and every separate person is involved is a myth that enables them to step aside from the fact that there's a tremendous amount of global warming that is the direct result of their own activities.
So one of the questions I've had for some time with the role of legal cases in social movements is how you move from these pretty detailed, highly footnoted briefs and motions into findings that can shift public discourse on climate change. And can you speak to that? Because the discovery evidence that, or testimony and discovery, it remains private. And for a very long time, these cases move along through the courts with various, you know, armies of lawyers involved. Usually the, you know, fossil fuel industry can lawyer up in a very, very powerful way. What do you see their potential for shifting, and I think contributing to the kind of radical transformative goals of the climate movement?
Well, they can be a big help. Of course, the whole movement has to range from direct action on the ground all over the world to stockholders who make resolutions at annual board meetings. But civil suits have a really important way, a role to play, because they can expose truth and admissions. Once these admissions are made, once these interrogatories are answered, then it's made public either directly or by leaks and becomes something that the fossil fuel industry has to explain. Well, we said that, but it was in a different context. Then media people will ask them questions about their testimony at a deposition. This is how the tobacco companies, for example, were diffusely attacked and generally discredited by information gleaned from civil suits and from the fact that some civil suits succeeded. But really, it's a process of information gathering and then information distribution where they can be really helpful.
And so perhaps we can continue to follow this case over time and contribute to some of that broader public discourse as these interesting motions and responses work their way through the courts and kind of evaluate the strategy as we go.
That's right.
This is Jan Hawken talking with Mike Snedeker today about civil suits against the fossil fuel industry.
Come lay down, they'll put you underwater like clay into a potter. They'll wash it dirty clean. Let's hear your plan for a natural world order. Free trade across the borders, gas efficient war machine. The dead tree needs a trimming, the poison earth needs weeding. Your houses are sinking in the seas, they are rising. It's also inconvenient, let's stall it while we can. And so it's business as usual, give the liberal a hand. Hey, Mr. Talk Radio, for once we agree that we can't afford no liberals in times like this. No, we can't afford no liberals in times like this. Times like this. Here in the brave new world, two sides of a grand old flag unfurled. Here in the brave new world.
That was Free Radical Radio Fever by Mischief Brew. That's an Obama-era punk song. Before that, the left and the law was considering legal cases and strategies for the climate justice movement as information is brought to light about how several companies knew all about climate change decades ago. I'm Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour, and I'm joined again today by Samantha Bryce from Voodoo Donuts and the Donut Workers United Union. The picket that I announced last week happened on Thursday. I went. It was really fun, uplifting. There was at least 100 people there, I think. Samantha, can you give folks a sense of how it went? Confirm my guess that there was at least 100 people there, and if anything's happened.
So, yeah, I think at about 7 p.m., we did a head count at the picket, and I believe there was about 150 community members who showed up in support of us, and that felt amazing. I think we talked a little bit the last time we talked about why we were doing this picket, but getting to be there on the picket line felt really good to me. Like you said, the energy was up. People were excited to be there, and it was just a great time overall. We picketed from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m., and pretty much kept that number of the 150 people up the whole time. We had various organizations there in support of us, including, you know, people like Growing Seeds Union and ILWU, we had the Teamsters come out, just a lot of different people there that kind of had our back, and along with just our general community and people of all ages too. We had kids and their parents, and we had grandparents. It just felt wonderful to see the community show up like that and really just show Voodoo Donut like how we feel about the way that they're treating their workers. It was great. It was great.
I brought my family down, and we weren't the only family there. There was even a moment when we took a break from walking around the picket, and some folks came up and said, "So what's going on here?" And very briefly explained how there's a picket and this is why it's happening. And they were going to Voodoo Donuts, and they said, "You know, we're from Chicago, so we understand these problems. What should we do?" And we just said, "Don't go here tonight." And they didn't. And that was in itself a powerful experience to feel solidarity working for people in your community and not just for you, and still kind of feel juiced by that.
Throughout the course of the picket line, actually, I was very impressed by how few customers actually walked through those doors to buy donuts. And thank you for chatting with people and all my other supporters who were there doing the same. I think the customers really got it when we kind of explained what was going on. I don't think anyone wants to see workers go through what we've been going through.
So in case people don't know, can we just go back to why the picket was there again before we dig deeper into the presence of the union there?
Kind of recap what led up to this picket. I've been, you know, doing the union struggle for a couple of years now. And recently we were faced with a situation where we were having record-breaking temperatures in Oregon. And leading up to those record-breaking temperature days, folks were really, really paying attention to how hot it was inside the shop. When those issues were addressed with management, management wouldn't listen to us, so workers went on strike. Sadly, nearly every worker who went on strike was set to be terminated, even though the strike was a legal health and safety strike around concerns of heat exhaustion and other various things and accidents that can happen when you're working in 100 plus degree temperatures in the kitchen. And so after those workers were fired, we decided it's time to kind of bring some heat down on the company for that.
How does the union want the community to support any of these ways that you're going after your boss?
Oh, absolutely. Plenty of ways to help support us right now. Currently, how I would recommend that folks lend their voices to supporting us is either through Voodoo Donuts social media pages, kind of letting them know what you think about what's going on, calling into the shop to also just kind of verbally explain how you feel about the treatment of staff at Voodoo Donut to a manager. You're also welcome to email the company through their website, contact them in that direction. But ways that you can help support us directly are by, you know, we do have a GoFundMe. All of the proceeds from that just go towards either furthering our movement or helping our either still employed or recently fired and coworkers with whatever financial help they need assistance with. But also, you know, just being able to show up to our actions when we have these sort of pickets or when we go on strike, lending your voice to the greater community. All of that, just turning out for us is really what we need. And everyone's been doing such a great job out there. And I just, from the bottom of our hearts at Donut Workers United, we want to say thank you to the community because y'all have been killing it for us. So
now I want to kind of zoom out and talk about the campaign to unionize there over the last couple of years, what that has been about in terms of what the organizing ends up actually looking like when workers are standing up for each other in different ways and or coming together to figure out what their problems are together. When did the campaign really kind of get going?
Well, we started really organizing and getting things done on the shop floor about 2 years ago around concerns of safety, seeing as many of our coworkers were being assaulted on the job by passerbys. But it also included, you know, issues like the heating and cooling situation at work. That has been a problem for years now, where the company has had people working in temperatures of 90 degrees or hotter inside the kitchen. And so this heat wave was just an extreme version of that. We got together around some issues like that. And of course, you know, the idea of compensation and respect on the job is always a big motivator for organizing. But really, I think of Voodoo, it more than anything comes down to our job security and our safety are our two biggest concerns. We started organizing around that, ended up pushing the company successfully to hire a security team to help protect the staff on the inside, especially after, I'm not sure if everyone heard, but about a year ago, we were robbed by a person with a hatchet inside our store. So there was definitely some concern for safety. We organized around that. And unfortunately, beginning of COVID, the company laid off over 30 employees due to COVID-related reasons. by that following June, when the COVID restrictions were lifting and the company started to reopen, they only hired back 5 of those 30 employees at the downtown location in a blatant act of union busting, mind you. And so we organized around that, trying to get our coworkers back on the shop floor who deserve to be there, who have put in, you know, 2, 4, 7 years of their life into this company. We just wanted them to be able to come back to work. And that was one of our big initial reasons for organizing and doing the push that we did. Beyond that, when the wildfires came last summer, the union was able to procure about 4 different boxes of KN95 masks, and we handed those out to each of the locations, to the workers, who were so happy and excited that we were able to bring them something, because the company supplied us with nothing to help with breathing air conditions during the smoke and the wildfires. Sadly, the company took it upon themselves to throw away all of the masks that we dropped off at the Davis location, the Old Town location, and the Oak Grove location. And it was heartbreaking to see the corporate management kind of showing their true colors, being more concerned with whether the union's helping than with the actual health and safety of their staff. After that, we were pushing for an election not too long ago. I'm sure this is something that folks heard about. We ended up tying with the company for the union election vote in the shop. And due to a technicality, the tie goes to the company. But we have been very, very firm in our belief that the election was just a step along a much longer road ahead of us. And we're not giving up. We will be continuing to escalate like we did yesterday with our picket and like we did with the heat wave strike. And we will keep pushing this union and supporting our coworkers and making sure that everyone is taken care of to the best of our own abilities. At the end of the day, the company's never going to have our back, and we have to be there for each other. And I think that the culture inside the shop has been very positive towards those sentiments. And I have nothing but faith that this union will continue to grow and continue to get stronger over the next year and into the future.
I'd like to hear that the workers themselves have confidence in each other and in their own sense of what they deserve together. I'm wondering whether that's just kind of there already, or if that is a quality that has been cultivated at all or brought out or built through organizing.
I've worked a lot of jobs in my life, and there has never been a workplace for myself where I have felt more loved and accepted by my coworkers than at Voodoo Donut. We legitimately care about each other, and we'll do anything that we can to help each other. And I think the union is more of a reaction to that, you know? I mean, like, this is kind of a natural step forward for the workers of Voodoo Donut. And yes, of course, the union helped cultivate these feelings and helped people feel empowered to be able to stand up for themselves and to do what's right for each other. But on the other hand, I do like to think to myself that this is a great staff, and this is a place where we all understand each other and just want what's best for each other. So a union was the next natural step in that progression. Because like I said, the last thing that the company has in mind is what's best for its workers. And they've shown that time and time again.
The name of the union is Donut Workers United. It's not the Voodoo Donut Workers Union. Could you say more about the name and its relationship to the idea of industrial organizing for donut making?
So initially, like you mentioned, when we first started this union, we did go by, what was it? Voodoo Donut Workers Union, which is a fine name, but myself and other workers as well really felt like we wanted to distance ourselves from the terminology Voodoo Donut being culturally appropriative enough without myself getting into all the names of the donuts and all the things that they do inside the shop. And so as a group, we decided it was best to change to get away from the term voodoo, seeing as our company was started by a couple of white yuppies who got really lucky with a neat donut idea. And we just don't want to further that appropriation. So we changed our names to Donut Workers United. And Donut Workers United was just a reflection of ourselves as donut workers. But of course, we would love to see in the future more donut shops and more pastry shops being able to find resources through us or support through us. We're here for our community, and if there's anyone that we can help that we have experience and we know what it's like working in those prior kitchens and things like that, we're here to help them too. One of our good friends, they're not a part of our union, but we have made great friends with another campaign I'd love to give a shout out to down in LA by the name of Donut Friend United, another punk donut shop who's been going through nearly the same struggle that we have, and we have nothing but love and solidarity for them. We're here to fight the good fight with whoever we can, so.
Would love to hear of other donut shops also taking to heart what you're saying about caring for each other. Could you say a bit more about how that caring for each other took steps to be more organized? Like, what did it take to organize that?
We were approached by workers in the shop. We're approached by another worker of ours, another coworker, who had the idea of forming this union. And luckily, we took steps towards the direction of what we knew. And what we knew was the Portland IWW. What we really appreciated about it was the sort of grassroots way of organizing, putting the power in the workers' hands and letting us have the final say. So that's why we chose to go with the Portland IWW. We're very happy with that decision. Been shown nothing but solidarity and support. And how that relates to other workers out there and why we did this, like through the IWW, we offer various forms of training for organizers, such as our organizer training 101. We offer a safe place to come and talk about organizing your workplace or just figuring out ways to solve problems on the work floor, even if you're not looking at organizing. And so with all those resources available to us from the Portland IWW, we've been able to train and get people ready for organizing in our own kitchens. And I guess kind of what I'm getting at when I talk about these other donut shops out there, like, we understand your struggle and we want to be here for you. Donut Workers United has your back, but Portland IWW is always here to help you learn and figure out how to take these steps and in these matters into your own hands and create a support system at your workplace. It's a beautiful thing, and I've never been more inspired by a group of people than I have since I've been working with the Portland IWW.
Full disclosure, I am a member of the Portland IWW as well. Well, I think
lovely.
I want to ask, like, how many people have been involved as a percentage of the workers there?
Typically, from the first point of really being organized up until these recent firings, we've been able to keep roughly a consistent 75 to 85% of the staff union positive over these last 2 years.
That's pretty good. So was there like a one-on-one campaign to systematically map out the workplace and assign people 1 to 5 numbers in terms of support for the union and notes on what they need to maybe be moved politically or just what they need?
We have our little ways of kind of like calculating where people are at and things like that. And to be honest, like we do take those things into consideration. But it's it feels a lot more organic than just like a playbook, if that makes sense. The support that we've been able to really gain from our coworkers, I'm trying to find a good way of phrasing this. To answer your question simply, yes, we definitely go through those OT 101 training steps.
I guess I'm wondering if you could say like how they've been helpful, because the IWW puts all this energy into promoting them and teaching them. So how have they been helpful?
So those sort of training steps that have been the most helpful to us, I think, was giving us kind of the real life experience of like how bosses are going to react to you when you stand up for yourself and how to handle that on the work floor, as well as being able to do things like map out your shop floor, figure out where your weak links are, and making sure to have a deeper conversation with those workers. You know, like at the end of the day, union organizing is really just hearing other people's stories and finding ways that you can connect to them and ways that you can help them. And I think what we got from that helped a lot in learning how to move forward and build those bridges between workers. At least for me, that's what the OT 101 training really, really helped me with, is just kind of learning how to approach people and taking a step back and looking at the situation and not seeing people as a number, but seeing them as an individual and what ways that you can help them specifically. And if you're able to help those people, everything else just comes along organically after that.
That's, I think, the kind of relational thing that we need in our movement to really build up the solidarity that gives us the strength to do these hard things together.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, to wrap up, what's in the future for Donut Workers United?
So the action was not just an action in Portland, Oregon. We actually carried out a national action at Voodoo Donut locations across the country with various locals of the industrial workers of the world coming out to show support and do friendly informational pickets at each of those other Voodoo locations. It was wonderful. And we plan on doing this again in the future. We don't have a set date, but we're not going to lift the pressure off the company anytime soon. So please, please keep an eye out for our further actions, further pickets, further actions that you might see happening at other Voodoo Donut locations across the country, because the fire's been lit. People know that this is possible. And I have a feeling that we are going to see a lot more of this in a lot more places very soon. So we plan on doing that. We'll keep bringing the fight to the company until the company starts treating their employees with kindness, compassion, and respect.
Thank you, Samantha Bryce, Donut Workers United, for coming on the Old Mole. We'll follow the case of these workers as time goes on.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
No prevention nor protection. No contraception. In the event of divine intervention and immaculate conception, the answer to the question of what is my profession? I'm that cat using rap as a weapon. Blasting, smashing the elaborate deception and casting an accurate reflection. I'm sculpting your perception with cultural connections. Aggressively created for spiritual reasons. Survival of my people, liberation and freedom. That's why I'm leading discussions on money, greed, and corruption, and the seduction, the lust, and destruction, and how we don't need this to function. The people are the means of production. Suffer to me, we need no introduction, and the global power structure needs adjustment just as much as my seed needs love, and peace won't see the light of day without justice. Why think I'm busting racks? I'm not a lush pushing a plush luxury bus full of sluts and cushions and back. No, that's not the facts. It's your language. Use it. Speak it. Communication is a gift. Don't keep it a secret. Articulation. Tweak it. Freak it. Let the people see it, say it, display it, and teach it. Transparency is needed. Apparently, we need to have clarity to see through the barbarian and evil used to deceive you. A message to the people. Don't let them keep you asleep, fool. I give a descriptive depiction of the resistance and friction, persistence through all of existence and struggles, predicaments and positions, complete with compromise, traumatized by disease and addiction. Still arise to my feet, fighting to be free and defeat opposition. Stop and listen to the common wisdom, drop succinctly in a way to get you thinking. There is no competition here. Just the need to live free, be relieved, and release fear. Allow me to make myself clear like antihistamines while I have the planet listening. Humanity's history, damage, and misery can be explicitly understood and put to use for common good instantly. There is no trick, gimmickry, or wizardry for us to physically, mentally live in victory. We're literally in possession of the blessings to eliminate our oppression. Love. And that's what's up. It's your language. Use it. Speak it. Communication is a gift, don't keep it a secret. Articulation, tweak it, freak it, let the people see it, say it, display it, and teach it.
That was Mike Crenshaw from his Thinking Out Loud album, Teach It. Mike Crenshaw is a KABU community member, hip-hop teacher and artist activist, former KABU station co-manager, was on Hard Knock Radio in the last month, talking about climate change, talking about breaking through the spells. Check him out. Well, that's all the time we have for today's Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Joe Clement. I've been our host. I'd like to thank today's contributors and their guests. Bill Resnick talked with Caitlin Day of Stop the Sweeps PDX about the End Clean and Safe campaign. Our Left in the Law duo, Jan Hawken and Mike Snediger, reviewed the trend in lawsuits being brought against companies for knowingly suppressing knowledge of the impacts of climate change. And thanks again to Samantha Bryce of Donut Workers United for coming on to talk with me about the picket last Thursday and the vision going forward for Donut Workers United. Thanks also to our pre-production editors, John Nelson and Denise Morris. It is a collective labor that makes the Old Mole possible. You can listen to the Old Mole at kboo.fm/oldmole. You can find past shows as a whole or as segments that you can share and mix and match. There you'll find more links and promised background information about the subjects on our show. You can reach out to us at our Gmail, oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com. We'd love to get your comments, your questions, or if you'd like to become a part of the show. KABU is a member-supported station. We get 80% or so of our operating budget from listener contributions and membership. And if you like what you heard today, if you feel like the kind of things that we are bringing to your ears and to the ears of people in your community, then help out. Make sure it keeps going forward. If you are not a member, you can become one at kboo.fm/give. For the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland, this has been Joe Clement.